And if you feel that you've got tools that really work for you with overthinking, controlling your emotions and anxiety, brilliant. You don't need it. But if you are continually finding yourself struggling with these, you got to ask yourself at what cost and what are you waiting for before you start doing something about it? Are you waiting for things to get really bad and desperate, essentially, before you try what will take you literally 2 minutes to make a massive difference in your life?
This is Humble Mind, a social learning community with an insatiable curiosity for new ideas and connecting with equally new and bold people in life and business. This podcast is where we get to speak with other unusual humble minds. And if you're a member of our community, you get to join our recording live, get access to early releases of new clips on our platform, our weekly newsletter, content from previous sessions, as well as an invitation to join our Thursday live group meetup. So check out join.humblemind.co for more. There's a $1 trillion digital economy dedicated to securing as much of your attention, your precious attention, as possible. For most of us, it means that we've got to fundamentally rethink how we deal with aspects of the digital world which encroach on our existence involuntarily. And the truth is that we need new tools to help us do this. The same old blogs, YouTube profits, uplifting audiobooks aren't necessarily going to cut it anymore. And today we're going to have a look at just exactly what those new bold tools are so that you might have a better way to reclaim your attention, your concentration, your confidence, and maybe, just maybe, have a better shot at navigating the digital modern world. Today, I'm extremely pleased to have Manj Barra, who is an ex-JP Morgan executive turned coach and author, of a new book entitled The Art of Moving On. It's not every day that you have an ex-JP Morgan executive turned coach and author on the podcast, so that's definitely cause for some celebration. So Manj, thank you for joining us today and our community.
Thank you very much for having me, Alex. Always a pleasure to speak to you, always learn something new, and I love the community you built as well.
Thank you. Lovely. Yeah, great to have you with us. So there's when we got together a couple of weeks ago, there's really so much to kind of talk about, and I think that we have a lot of overlapping areas, which just excites me. And I think that we'll certainly get into some of that, and we'll leave some of it maybe for a future episode for sure. But maybe just to bring kind of everyone into some context, that part about you being this kind of diehard VP front of house at JP Morgan in London to who you are today as a coach, as a writer, as I would assume a completely different person. Maybe just walk us through some of the highlights, or I'm sure there are many highlights and lowlights, but some of the basics of that story, that trajectory, and what happened to you?
Yeah, what happened? So, going right back to the beginning, I really didn't know what I wanted to do for work or for my career. I was studying geography at University College London, and we all on the course were kind of thinking, where are we going with this degree? What are we supposed to do with these skills? And I kind of just got lucky that I got a job on the IT help desk. And once I got that job, it allowed me to apply for technology jobs across different industries. So my first internship was in Microsoft. From Microsoft, I went to a Swiss bank called UBS. And then I finally ended up at JP Morgan. So my actual entry point into banking was through the technology graduate scheme. And I started right at the back of back office in data center technology, which is probably not where most people want to be when they're starting as a new graduate. You think of the banks and you think of Wall Street, Canary Wharf, trading desk, numbers. I was literally there responsible for the cabling and these big machines that power everything. In hindsight, it was actually great because I got a chance to see the organization from the ground up. And from there, I took various different stepping stones. I moved into electronic trading technology. I then moved into becoming a business analyst. And then from there, I got very lucky and moved into the front office as a product manager in FX and rates. So I started right at the back, and then just over the course of nearly 10 years, kind of worked my way up from graduate to vice president towards the end.
Wow. So, and I mean, you're quite young. So, I mean, that must have taken place over a pretty quick period.
Yeah,
where it was just rising through the ranks, right?
Yeah, I think where it can be misleading is vice president doesn't necessarily mean the same as executive vice president as in other companies. In a JP Morgan, a vice president means that you are decent high level, essentially. And I wouldn't say it was rapid, but it was quick. Quick turnaround, and probably got promoted a bit too early in hindsight. Me and some of my friends were all part of the same group that got promoted at the same time. And we really wanted it. We thought, no, go for it, go for it, go for it. And then you get there and realize everyone else is a 20-year veteran and you really don't know anything. So it takes you time to be, you know, like your podcast says, humble about it and truly understand it's not always the worst thing to take your time to get to where you want to go.
Right.
But you figure it out when you get there, that's for sure.
So with all of this kind of success and these early wins and the promotions, I would imagine, you know, a lot of people in your shoes would have kind of kept going, right? And perhaps would still be there today, perhaps even in a higher level of seniority, but you're not.
Yeah.
Instead, you're on Humble Mind.
So
what happened?
Absolutely. So going back to when I came into the bank and that data center team, I had my eyes on becoming front of house from the very beginning. That's what I wanted.
Which means
they would call it front office, where you're in sales, trading, product management, these kinds of roles that are on the trading floor, where you associate banking with and what you associate banking with, as opposed to being in the technology side, operation side, or HR, for example. These are the money-making roles, put simply. And when I started, that's what I wanted. And I found a really interesting thing happened. When I landed there, I thought, wow, this is not what I thought this would be at all. I was genuinely shocked. I thought I was in Game of Thrones for the first time. Up until that point, all the managing directors had been awesome. The people I worked with were incredible. And I felt genuinely part of something bigger. And I really did enjoy myself at the time. When I landed in this trading environment, things were very different. And suddenly you had to worry about what you said to a certain person. You were second guessing the intentions of other people around you. You were hearing stories about the directors above you. And that started to really change my thinking about, is this who I want to be as a person? Do I want to be my boss, my boss's boss, or even higher? Not necessarily as people, but more into what they're dealing with and what they're doing. And is this the impact I want to leave on the world? So around 2018, I'd been there for 5 years and I actually got the chance to do a sabbatical. So you can take a bit of time off and then come back to your role. When I did that, I really got more in touch with something that I always loved, which was coaching, helping people. Even going back in my career, the most enjoyment I had in all the jobs at JP Morgan was being on a help desk, literally just solving people's problems. So during that time in 2018, I got my coaching qualifications. I started writing online, and that became kind of my outlet in a sense of actually making a difference in other people's lives and really doing what I loved. I carried on with that for a few years. It slowly organically built. And then it came to this point just around COVID, where it was like, you've got to make a decision here. And I think COVID kind of helped because we were seeing the reality of life and how, you know, it can change very, very quickly.
Mm.
And I had to decide, do I want to keep doing this? Do I want to be this person? Or do I want to go all in and actually make a difference in the way that I feel I can? And that's when I made the decision to leave. You know, right when I got my biggest paycheck, my biggest bonus, right when I was in the position to start capitalizing, become more senior, to really leverage everything I built, I had to make that tough call. And here we are a few years later, and it's the best thing I've ever done. Not to say that it wasn't very scary, as I'm sure we'll get into, but that's kind of the origin story.
And so, and kind of looking back now since then, now that you have indeed embraced that new kind of career path and that it's allowed you to explore a whole lot of things that I would imagine would have not been possible had you stayed and had you continued, have you kind of been able to reverse engineer what what was the central thing that you didn't kind of agree with you at the fiber, you know, at the core of your being? Was there just something that like was not going to cut it for you and with you? Or was it more of a kind of a, I really just don't want to be indoors all the time? Or like, have you been able to kind of chalk it up to a couple of very specific things?
Yeah, I think for me, what it was asking myself a question. Because when I, even the first year that I joined JP Morgan, excuse me, so I remember getting into trouble at work for something really silly, and thinking, wow, this is going to be my life for the next 20, 30 years. And I wanted to leave at that point. I always wanted to be that kind of entrepreneur and do things that made a difference and have more autonomy and do things a little bit different. But it took me a long, you know, 8 to 9 years to actually go through with it. And that doesn't mean I didn't try. I tried numerous times to leave JP Morgan and I couldn't ever get there. It was only at the point that I asked myself, what am I waiting for? Whose permission am I waiting for? That I really started to understand what was holding me back. And for me, I realized I was waiting for permission from really my parents and my wife. So whenever I discussed leaving with my mum, she always had 100 reasons why I shouldn't, and she always managed to convince me. And in hindsight, what I realized was I was going to her waiting for her approval to say, yes, you can leave now, which she's never going to give because I already have doubt if I'm having to seek her approval. And so once I got clear on no one can make this okay for me, I have to make this choice and I have to find out now because there's nothing else to wait for. Just do it now or don't do it at all. Then when I went to my mum and said, hey, I'm doing this on this date, you know, let me know what you think. She was all for it. She was all like, no, that's good. It sounds like you're finally made your mind up. You're actually going to do it this time. And it's because she knew that I had conviction in it. And this time I wasn't waiting for anyone else to tell me it's going to be safe. I'm definitely going to succeed. All these things you're never going to get the answer to. Right. And actually, I just decided, all right, I'm committing to this and whatever happens, happens. I think that's the biggest thing. And then one other thing is just really looking around and thinking, do I want my boss's job? Do I want my boss's job and the one above that? Do I feel I'm making a difference here? Is this how I want to be remembered? Those are kind of like the nails in the coffin for me.
Yeah, I think we can all kind of relate in a way. And it's great that you had that reaction from your mom or your loved ones, where I think a lot of the time that holds us back too, where we think other people are going to react in a certain way, and so we don't confront it, or we don't do it, or we don't come to them, or we don't ask that question. But so often, as I have been, and perhaps everyone else as well listening, you're kind of pleasantly surprised when you do have it, because, you know, more often than not, people want the best for you. And if you aren't sort of, you know, jiving with something, chances are they can see that, you know, and perhaps they're just waiting for you to take that first step, which is interesting, right? How interesting how
100%.
we're, yeah, we're often beholden to those expectations.
Yeah, and I remember speaking to my coach at the time, who I just hired, and he was saying to me, "What is it you want from me to tell you right now to make you do this step?" And part of me wanted him to say, "It's going to be okay. You're definitely going to be successful." And he said to me, "I can't tell you that. Nobody can tell you that, right?" And that was really powerful for me, as simple as it sounds. It was just that moment of realization. If I'm waiting for this order or sequence of events to happen, they ain't going to happen. So you have to flip it around almost and just do it first and figure it out. And that doesn't mean you don't plan with, you know, you don't take unnecessary risk. You still figure out the best way to do it, but you make the decision that I am doing this, which is a whole different step in itself.
Absolutely. On your LinkedIn page, it says that your kind of byline is that, you know, I help people silence the inner critic, destroy limiting beliefs, and reach their potential. So how do you do this? And how do you help them to ask the right questions without needing to, like you went to that coach when you said to that guy, tell me what I want, I need to know, you know. What's your approach to those kinds of things, where perhaps somebody who might have been, you know, who's in your shoes where you were 5, 6, 7 years ago, how do you normally kind of work with them and get them to think differently?
Yeah, I think one idea that has been central to my coaching is you haven't taken the step because you don't want to, right? There's a reason why you haven't done it that makes complete logical sense. And most of the time, that's due to some benefit of staying the same. So whenever I talk to someone and they might say, I really want to start this business, I don't believe them by default, because that's not the truth. There's something else that's holding them back. There's a fear there, or there's something they don't want to lose that they think they'll lose if they start taking that step. We need to go a little bit deeper. And sometimes what people believe they want isn't actually what they want at all. When you say starting a business, do you really understand what that means? I spent 2 hours yesterday fixing my website, and this is the kind of stuff you deal with when you're your business owner. Whereas at JP Morgan, I'd write a little ticket and someone would come and do it for me. That doesn't mean to say I don't have some amazing things, freedom, autonomy, you get to choose what I do. But there's a lot of nonsense around it as well. And sometimes we just have these ideas based on what you see on social media, what you think you should be doing, what other people want for you. So when I'm meeting someone, I want to get really deep down into what's their values, what is it they're really connected to. Go to the heart first. Then we can sort of take the conversation somewhere else. I don't want to know what your head's saying, because that's irrelevant at this stage. We start with the heart. What do you desire? What do you connect with? What is it you truly value? And then we can start having a valuable conversation, I think.
Yeah. I want to come back to that around starting with the heart instead of the head, because I think you're starting to get people to really sort of, at least what I'm reading online and the conversations I have with different people, business owners and so on, there's a little bit more of this vocabulary just starting to kind of sort of settle into what feels normal, you know, and I think it's kind of taken a long time to get there, you know, because it's often been dismissed as too woo-woo or too kind of out there, or like, what do you mean, you know, and so on. So there's such an interesting trajectory, and I want to come back to that. But just now going to the kind of the premise of our conversation, which was this idea of, you know, the digital world, the modern world, rather, not just the digital world, where, you know, I don't want to kind of overstate it, because you know, even describing what sounds like the modern world automatically sounds like a cliche. You know, there's so many things, fast paced, and, you know, your attention and da 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 and technology, blah blah blah. You know, it sounds like an opening paragraph from an insurance commercial, right? So how do you sort of see the state of the modern world, and I suppose specifically, where is it not working for us? Where is it hurting us?
I think one thing that really comes to mind for me, and to be completely transparent with you, I'd say 80% of my clients are in the relationship realm, and they're looking to kind of attract partners or have healthier relationships or change their dating patterns. And the other 20% are looking to start a business or just change something about their career. And what's interesting about that is they're all struggling with the same things that we call these modern day challenges. And I think the biggest part of that is information overload. You're just flooded with so much information on a day-to-day basis. You don't know who to trust or whether anything is actually valid or verified. What kind of trustworthiness do you put on the source? And I think the other part of that is just the dopamine exposure we have to quick hits. You can go now onto TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and you can get that hit of pleasure from doing absolutely nothing but swiping your finger. And what that's doing to us, which I think we're becoming more aware of, and people have this working knowledge of it, but what it's really doing is it's training our brains to get a hit from doing nothing. Whereas you go back even 10 years, a bit longer though, really 20 years and above, the dopamine cycle was you would do some work, get a reward, and repeat, right? You would have to do something in order to feel good. It wasn't just do that or go and binge on Netflix. Not saying that there isn't a place for all these, but it's what are we learning and reinforcing? Yeah. And I see that in careers. Everyone wants to jump between job to job. They want the career now. Like I was with my, you know, I wanted to be a VP before I was ready for it. You see it in dating. People become addicted to the chase, what people who don't quite want them, but maybe they can win them over, swiping on the dating apps. It's absolutely, I don't know quite the word for it, not being vulgar, but it is kind of crazy what's happening out there.
So I know that you have a particular interest in how the brain works and kind of neuroscience as well. You thread that into what you talk about, what you write about. Maybe just for a moment, you can kind of just go into a bit of detail there about what actually happens around that dopamine kind of vicious cycle, because I think it's such an important thing to understand and to know about. And I think it's become one of those things, and perhaps this is another trait of modern world as well, where people have a surface level knowledge of those things. And that surface level knowledge is enough to kind of know, yeah, I've heard about that, or some guy on Instagram has mentioned that, but not necessarily enough of the depth to really get a sense of, oh shit, this is maybe something I need to pay attention to. Maybe you can just enlighten us for 60 seconds or so, just what actually happens to the brain and why is it hurting us?
I think the most important thing to start with is, you know, your basic understanding of dopamine is it's a hormone, you know, neurotransmitter that makes you feel really good. It gives you a hit, right? It's a reward, essentially. And what our bodies do and our brains do, rather, is they learn what gave us that reward. So whenever you get a hit of dopamine, it wants it again, and it's naturally going for the easiest thing that gives it to you, right? As I was saying, 10, 20 years ago, you didn't have these options for instant gratification. Now we do have them. The other things that are really important to understand is that with modern day dopamine, it rises in anticipation of a reward, and it's at its highest when there's 50% certainty. And what that really means is it's not about doing the work and getting the result. It's thinking about the result, you know, what might happen. And when it's a literal 50% of one way or the other, that really spikes the dopamine secretion. And what's interesting about this, if just to apply it in a JP Morgan scenario, the way they would do this to you, you get a bonus every year, but once a year, right? You do all that work, hoping, thinking, what will the bonus be this year? You're anticipating it all the time. When January comes around, people are talking all over the office. Did you hear what the numbers were like? What's your department like? Will I be up? Will I be down? And you work, it gets the work out of you because you're thinking, this is what gives me the dopamine. And then on the day it happens. And then you'll think, well, what about next year? What's my anticipation for then?
Yeah.
Or in the next job offer? And it just keeps you in this cycle over and over and over again.
And so I suppose the net kind of effect of that is that we're just never satisfied.
Right? Yeah, and I think it's what have you trained your brain to respond to? So if you're getting the hit out of going online and, you know, swiping videos, if you're doing it out of seeing your own notification, even checking your emails, I mean, there's dopamine everywhere if you go to work. You've got chats coming up on Skype, on Slack, your emails coming through, what your boss might say to you. At home, you've got it through Netflix, Amazon. If you order a package, you want it instantly now, right? And you're waiting for that package to come on your door, literally. Some people get a real hit out of that. And so we're just learning this is what makes us feel good, so we want to do that. Really sophisticated way of doing it, buying books. You get the hit from buying the book, but not from reading it or finishing it.
Oof.
You know, I'm completely guilty.
All my deepest, darkest secrets here.
Yeah. And so that's why it's really important just to understand how have I trained? And it's not necessarily how have I, it's how are we being trained by the environment around us to reward ourselves, and what do we respond to? And how can we think about that differently?
You had a couple of weeks ago when we were just thinking about some of the bits of conversation we would have for this podcast, you mentioned something which I ended up just jotting down because I just liked it and I had it in my mind for a little while and I picked it up again. And perhaps it's connected to this in a way to help to break the cycle of how we normally work with dopamine. The phrase or the little saying was, pick a religion and follow it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that? Where did that come from?
It came from me having this realization about the books that I've got. I mean, well, I'm looking there, 100 there, 100 there, hundreds of books. But am I implementing anything from them? Probably not, to be quite honest with you. But what if I just picked one book from a person that I trust, that I know has done really, done the things that I want to do and more, let's say, and I just followed that and tested without any interference outside from anyone else, or any program hopping, or just changing direction, just when things might start to work, what would happen? And so I've done this. I have one book on my bedside table, which is the Alex Hormozi Leads book, or Offers book, sorry.
Yeah, that's a great book.
And I just read that now, and it has genuinely transformed my life. But it's not just that, it's when I'm following a workout program, it's just that. I'm not Googling different signs of different ways to build muscle, lose fat, or whatever. I'm just committing to creating content on one, not just committing, but I'm really focusing on one platform, one topic. Doing these, then I can see, does this actually work? And one of the ideas that I got this from, or one of the reasons I had this idea, when I studied the science of flow recently, they talked about you're going to go through this period of struggle when you do anything, about 20 minutes. You're going to sit there and stare at this thing you need to do, and it's going to hurt. And you're going to say, I can't do this. I don't know what to do next. But if you stick with that for 20 minutes, you'll enter the flow state. And once you're in the flow state, you're going to be really hot. Ideas are going to be coming, and you're going to feel great because dopamine is being released and other hormones as well. But what they said is if you have any distractions during that 20 minutes, if you look away, if you start opening another email, you reset that clock to zero. And when you think about it like that, that's very powerful. I've got to be just focused for these 20 minutes. And the results are genuinely outstanding, even for someone with me who can't pay attention to anything.
So the kind of the premise, and just going back to what you said, pick a religion and follow it for a while. I suppose it's the underlying bit of truth there is this, the sense of, I suppose, discipline is one word, but also even discipline is such a big kind of, steely word that I think a lot of people really hate. Maybe it takes them back to high school. It certainly does for me. But, pick something, follow it for a while, and kind of get through that dopamine fog so that you can, the clock works for you rather than it works against you. Is that how you might characterize it?
Yeah, I think it's you find out what actually works for you by doing it and just doing that. And how often do we find that you try six different things in your business or in your personal life and then none of them work? But even if one of them did, you don't know which one was the cause of that. So you don't get very good insights into what works for you if you're trying to do too many things, if you're trying to run in many directions. So the premise of pick a religion is to really just say, look, I'm following this for 6 weeks. Let's see what happens. And the irony is, pretty much you follow anything for 6 weeks, it delivers some sort of result. And by the end of that, what you've learned is this works. I want to do it again, or I want to just tweak it a bit, rather than learning this doesn't work. Let me look for the next big thing. Doesn't work. Let me look for the next big thing and go hopping from different approaches, never learning anything. Never getting what you want done.
Yeah, absolutely. Rana has just shared with me, the we've lost the value in experiencing the struggle. So perhaps that's kind of really what's at the core here. We don't like being faced with something that's uncertain or painful or unpredictable, or something that we feel is going to show us up in some way, and so we create and invent sometimes very sophisticated ways of being able to avoid that, right? I think as human beings, we're experts at denial. Right, and so it means then that the quality of the reward is kind of that much less, because there's an unwillingness to experience, a sense of, a negative emotion or a negative experience, which is just part of life, right?
100%. And I think that's the real, it's a beautiful way of putting it. Yeah, we've lost that value of struggle. There's a great book, I believe it's called The Obstacle is the Way. It's kind of a stoic approach, which is whatever's in your way is the way to go forward. And that's with flow as well. The resistance is the price you pay for this amazing experience afterwards. And we are really reluctant. And this is probably where toxic positivity has got a little bit out of hand, is if you get a negative emotion or experience, we just want to shove that away and don't want to deal with it. And we find ways, quick hits of dopamine, to make us feel better in the moment. But the struggle is where you learn the most, 100%. And I think the more comfortable you can get with facing even tiny struggles, just a little bit at a time, can be absolutely transformative in your life.
You mentioned something, I picked it up on your LinkedIn bio, which is kind of going back to coaching, but it's linked to what you just said now about the coaching and being able to experience it, especially experience the negative side that we're all trying to avoid for yourself. You said many coaches go straight into coaching without ever getting the experience, the life experience. I have lived it and have made it happen. So do you feel that this is, I mean, just zooming out, there's such a massive coaching industry, right? Everybody's sort of mum and brother these days is a coach. You know, everyone has a coach. And in many ways, I think this reflects a real positive thing, you know, because it means that people are being more open to spend time on being coached and to think that that's a worthy use of their time, their money, their effort. So that is a good thing, and that definitely needs to be called out. But at the same time, it obviously means that you're going to get coaches and coaches, right? Mm. You get some coaches that are great and some coaches that are maybe, you know, not so great yet, and they're kind of winging it, or they don't really have a system, or, you know. So walk me through your thinking there, and do you think that it means that we're living in a time where you have a whole lot of false prophets? Have the prophets always been there? What do you think?
No, I 100% agree. The way I think about it is there are black belts and then there are black belts, and it depends on the lineage, right? You know, if you go to who did you learn from as a coach and who did they learn from, right? And what's their experience and credibility? My two biggest coaches both have coached for 20 years, since before it was cool, before it was a LinkedIn thing. And they both hate the industry now, to be quite honest with you. They don't know how it's become the way that it is now and how anyone can coach and whether people really understand why they're coaching or what coaching is. And I think part of that is, again, instant gratification. People think they can just start a coaching business and earn 10K months, which you see on LinkedIn all the time. And they don't commit the time to mastery of coaching or understanding the art form of it and what that really means. I'm really lucky. I've learned from some incredible people, and I'm aware of where, you know, I might be overstepping the mark myself as a coach. You know, might be trying to rescue clients that I don't need to be doing that for, and they don't want me to be. But I can only identify that because I work with my own coach who's got 20 years experience. So, you know, long story short, it is very scary to see where it is at. At the same time, that shouldn't be, it's probably more of a reason for someone like me to continue doing what I'm doing, to make sure it doesn't dilute the industry and doesn't become just the thing that we do, where we make people pay extortionate amounts of money to pretend to be gurus and deliver incredible transformations overnight.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's in many ways, I used to have that kind of thinking as well, where I used to be quite distrustful of coaches. I still don't really like the word coach, even though it's a good word for what it means. You know, you're on the sidelines and you're helping, you're not rescuing. But at the same time, it, you know, there's a sort of a Tony Robbins effect where it's kind of like, boom, results, you know, in your door, and this is what it looks like, and Hollywood, and cue the music. Whereas I think a lot of the time, you know, the real progress, at least for me, has just been quietly sitting and thinking or meditating or journaling and kind of, you know, having little moments that were facilitated by someone's question, you know, who was listening to me and they knew what to say and they got me thinking, you know, they got me focused on the right questions, which is, I think, what a coach really should be doing, right?
Yeah, the way I boiled it down for myself now, and it, just to simplify everything, is my job is to help the client take the next step. That's it. Whatever's getting in the way of the next step, I can help them figure that out and understand whether they truly want to take it or they don't. They have to take it. Where coaching gets dangerous is where you're telling the client the next step and where you're forcing them to take it and they don't really want to, because you want to get them a result. You want them to be that testimonial at the end. That's not your job. Your job is to help them take action, understand what's really stopping them. Provide some tools and frameworks that you've learned, share stories. That's very powerful. But it's not to be your rescuer. It's not to be a guru. it's not to be Tony Robbins, essentially, because it's not what we're here for.
Tony, if you're listening, you heard it here. Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to those sort of tools and frameworks, those sorts of things, the premise of what we're talking about, navigating this kind of modern world, because clearly we do need help with it. What are some of those things? And how could you, or how could we talk about it and give somebody an introduction, perhaps even maybe for the first time, hearing about it, which doesn't scare them off, but also perhaps invites a level of curiosity where they're actually keen to try it and to give it a chance. What are some of those things for you that's worked or that's helped others?
Tools that work, you mean?
Yeah, tools, or you know, we spoke a little bit about breath work. There's a couple of other things. So yeah, maybe some top of mind for you.
Yeah, I think breath work is one of the staples that I end up going back to repeatedly. And I think, you know, much like you had the distrust of coaches, I had the distrust of breath work for a very long time. And I still hate the fact that it works, because it's so bloody simple. But I think I showed on LinkedIn, I've got this thing here, it's a heart math monitor. You can pick these up at heartmath.org or something, or find a link. This is just basically an HRV monitor, and you link it to your phone, put it on your ear, and it shows you a measure of coherence, which is a measure they use to check that your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems are aligning. So the way you use this is basically balanced breathing. You do 5 seconds in, 5 seconds hold, and 5 seconds out, repeat, and you focus your energy on the heart. But why I love this monitor is because it's giving you real-time feedback, biofeedback, and there's no guesswork involved. If you're starting to stabilize, feel calm, balance at your best, you'll see a perfect sine wave. If you're stressed, if you're feeling anxious, if you're not quite where you want to be, you will see it on the graph. It will be all over the place. And then when you start to really do the breath work, you'll see it stabilize, which is just an incredible thing. Because as soon as you see it work, you trust it and you know, okay, this is something I can go to. Doesn't cost any money. It's something that's there for me whenever I want it. No coaches needed, no guesswork. I would start there for anyone who's looking to just explore non-cognitive ways of controlling emotions, of controlling anxiety, and controlling overthinking, just as number one.
And before we go through some of the other ones, but how is there anything that you could say, or perhaps a sales pitch, if you like, for someone who is hearing you and they're going, that sounds cool, but chances of me doing it are less than like 5%. How is there an idiot's guide or something that you've found as a sort of a foolproof way to sort of just do it? Just start with the first one and then the second one, because you said you hated breath work. Was there something that worked for you to kind of stick through some of it?
Well, I think the data, I think a little bit difficult because I had the monitor. So with my example, I just wanted to test. I want to take the nonsense out of it. I've seen all these videos, people saying breath work's amazing, you know, do it. When you see it live and you see this is me now and this is what I'm like 5 minutes later and I know I feel better, that's really validating. But I think for anyone who's not quite sold on it, is to ask yourself what tools you do have that you use. And if you feel that you've got tools that really work for you with overthinking, controlling your emotions and anxiety, brilliant, you don't need it. But if you are continually finding yourself struggling with these, you got to ask yourself, at what cost? And what are you waiting for before you start doing something about it? Are you waiting for things to get really bad and desperate, essentially, before you try what will take you literally 2 minutes to make a massive difference in your life? Mm-hmm. You have to make that choice yourself and decide, when am I going to do something about it, essentially? And breath work is so easy. 5 seconds in, 5 seconds hold, 5 seconds out. There's nothing to lose from it. It's just doing it. Place your hand on your chest and just do it, right? Mm. Give it a go.
Yeah, you remind me of a quote that I heard on the podcast with Stephen Bartlett. I think he was speaking with Mel Robbins, and she had this phrase, no one is coming. Nobody's coming to get you out of bed earlier, to make you go to the gym, to make you leave your job, to fix your relationship with your wife, whatever it might be. No one's going to help. No one's coming in life to tell you to do those things, right? You've got to get there yourself, which is in a sense, I suppose, what a coach is there to kind of help you realize and to sort of prompt in a way. The coach is not going to be there to do those things, and neither are these tools, right? They're not going to sort of push you out of bed or push you to do that thing. It starts with that effort, right? That sense of effort that comes first. I also want to just draw attention for a moment that the kinds of tools we're thinking about and talking about here, it's interesting because had we been having this conversation maybe 10 or 12 years ago, and the kinds of content that I was looking at the time, Gary Vee and all these guys, it was all about kind of optimizing and hustle and kind of productivity. Yeah. How many things can you do? How much can you fit into the day? And in many ways, I'm still trying to sort of come to grips with some of that wiring, some of that programming, because I'm still like that a lot of the time, you know. But so now it's almost like kind of unwinding all of that stuff and realizing that the tools is, it sounds trite, but it's not about kind of squeezing more into the box, but rather finding ways to have less in front of you. Because I find that when there's less to do and there's more kind of just stable, straightforward kind of tools that I feel I'm drawn to, then I actually get better things done. The results are better. I feel better. I'm not stressed and so on, rather than trying to pack it with all that optimizing and productivity.
Yeah, a useful way of thinking about this is coming all the way back to what we talked about with flow. The four stages of flow are struggle, the release, flow, and then recovery. Right? That's the science around it. And it's that last bit, recovery. When I was talking to the scientists about it, that's the bit that people miss, right? You don't get to be hustle, hustle, hustle. It's just not possible. To perform at your best, you have to be intentional about your time. I'm doing this now. Like we said, commit to the religion. You are doing this now. You have your struggle, your flow, right? You get there. Then afterwards, you got to just recharge, right? Breathwork's one way of doing it. A hilarious way they were teaching me, they said, go stare at a wall for 30 minutes. Genuinely, they're like, just stare at a wall. Allow yourself to be bored. Just learn how to be bored. Cold water, another one that I really, maybe we can talk about that a bit, but one that I really appreciate just for recovery and rewiring your dopamine. But the whole point is you need the recovery to perform at your best. And that's why you can't just go, go, go. You need to be being in the world as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a give and take, ultimately, right? We can't just be taking from our machine because our body and our minds are finite resources. And if we're not giving back, then, you know, you can't operate on an empty tank, essentially. Yeah. Even though I think we've been led to believe you can.
Yeah, and we all fall for it still, right? We still think, oh, I've got to do more here. And the quality of what you produce in those moments is never as much as or as high quality as what you can at your best.
What are some other tools, and perhaps other tools that maybe aren't as, because breath work, you mentioned cold water exposure, absolutely. I suppose there's always some of the normal ones, which is exercise, perhaps finding some time to meditate, developing a meditation practice. What are some of the other ones perhaps that, you know, are on the second layer?
Well, I do think that rather than thinking so much about exercise, it's just movement. If you can move your body, 10,000 steps is a great thing to aim for, not because of any science around it, but just getting to that number requires a bit of effort. You can't get to 10,000 without getting out for at least an hour. But going back to what we talked about with the breath work or even with coaching, if you just learn to move your body, objects in motion tend to stay in motion. It can be so powerful for you. If you even just do 10 squats, if you get on the floor, get back up again, you know, if you just get outside for a bit of sunlight, moving is one of the best antidotes to the modern day world, I think. Because we stay stuck in these desks, we're in these dopamine cycles, we're working long hours. You just commit to a bit of movement. So good for your brain health. It's so good for your dopamine, and it's so good for the quality of thinking and clarity of thinking that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. I always find myself loving and appreciating that I make a bit of time for yoga or run in the morning. And of course, you always feel that when you don't do that, you know, how off kilter the day, the rest of the day is. However, I've found, and I'm interested to see if this is everyone else's reflection too. If I miss that slot, whether it might be afternoon or early in the morning, for me it's early in the morning, then I convince myself that it's now, that's it. I can't do it again in the day. I'm not going to have another chance. That's it. Sorry, you missed the train, and now you're just going to have to kind of live with it. How do I talk myself out of that? Because that's bullshit, right? What's at play there?
I think one of the most common challenges I see with clients is it's that all or nothing mentality. So if
Oof.
I don't do it all the way, then I'm not going to do it at all. So one of the methods I learned from one of my coaches, absolutely brilliant method, it's called EASE. So that's EASE. Stands for easy, acceptable, stretch, and extraordinary. And what most people do is when they take on any endeavor, highly motivated people like yourself, they'll go for the extraordinary. I'm going to hit 10,000 steps today, or I'm not going to hit any, or they'll go to nothing at all. So it's extraordinary or nothing at all. And because of that, those days that you don't hit anything, you will then justify why there's no point doing it because you've got to do it perfectly, right? You're missing the levels in between. So what's the easy thing for you to do, which is not doing nothing? What's acceptable? You think, okay, that was okay. What's stretch, just a bit above that, and what's completely extraordinary? And if you define what that is for yourself, you've got four different standards you can hit. And as long as you hit one of them, you've made progress today. Hit one single one. And the irony of it is, if you hit the easy, you will always hit the acceptable because you'll get a dopamine hit. I've done this. Now I can do the next. You're in motion. You will do the next thing. The beauty of the system is what's acceptable to you becomes easy. What's easy becomes automatic. What starts as extraordinary becomes your stretch. What was stretch becomes acceptable. And over time, you're just building new and new, newer circuitry that makes what was once difficult completely automatic.
Beautifully said. What starts as easy becomes, or what did you say? What becomes easy becomes acceptable.
So the other way around is that what's difficult for you just becomes easier and easier, and what's easy eventually becomes automatic. So, you take this behavior, let's say it's going to the gym. It might be extraordinary for you to do a 30-minute workout when you start. It might be a stretch for you to do a 15-minute workout. Might be acceptable to just turn up at the gym. It might be easy for you to just put your gym kit on. If you were to just go with the all or nothing belief, you'd go straight to the 30-minute workout, and there'll be many days where you don't want to do that and you don't feel up. But if you say, all I have to do is hit that easy level and put my gym kit on, that's easy. So you'll do that, and then you'll be like, well, I might as well just go to the gym. And then you've won, right? And soon, easy, where you put your gym kit on, it's not even a thought, you just do it. Getting to the gym is just the easy for you. Doing a 30-minute workout is your stretch. Doing an hour becomes your extraordinary. This is just how you gently rewire over time. Give yourself little milestones in between instead of jumping to the all or nothing.
It's so fascinating how it's almost like there's an inner child in the brain, and you've got to be able to learn how to talk and to deal and to correct the behavior of the brain, I suppose. In this case, the more, I'm not sure if it's the brainstem or the amygdala, but the kind of the parts of the brain that dictate sort of, am I going to get out of bed or not? Am I going to do that? Is it? And it's and you have to kind of rewire it, but treat it as if it was a child, and I suppose for me, I've got children, so I know what that experience is like. And you really have to kind of walk it through these sort of stages, like almost soothe it until it gets to start doing what you need it to do, because it seems to be quite a otherwise quite a stubborn thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the amygdala, as you say, the survival brain, been around the longest out of all the brain features. It's kept us through so much danger. It's a complete miracle that we're alive today. We've outlasted creatures that were stronger, way more powerful, way faster. And we are slow, we smell, and our young scream. So you can always tell what a human is back then. We were literally the fast food of the world, McDonald's of the world. How have we survived? The amygdala has developed rapid responses. We can fight when we need to. We can freeze, play dead. We can run away and we can fawn. We can people please and we can negotiate. We learn these things, and your brain only cares about safety and certainty in the moment. So as you said, if you can just gently create that safety or a certain level of certainty, that's the key to getting you to take it and realize, okay, it's all right if I do this. It's safe to do this. Rather than just jumping to, hang on a minute, you're doing this new thing, don't like that, let me think of any reason not to do it. Oh, we can't do it perfectly, let's not do it at all. Risky. And then here we are, you know, 6 months later, trying to go to the gym and struggling.
Yeah, absolutely. How I have a question about guilt. And I wonder if Russ and Rana, who are with us still, feel this way too. So I know that something is good for me, whether it's to stop scrolling through LinkedIn or Instagram, get up and put my shorts on and my shoes on and go for a run and all that. But I still feel like I have to be able to sit at my desk and I've got to be working. And working includes sitting and kind of like typing emails and you know, getting on calls and being busy, right? I suppose that's the operative word, the busyness of being at work. And if I'm not busy, I'm guilty. And certainly if I go and take time out for myself, 20, 30 minutes for a run or stretch or something, then that same guilt kind of taps in. And it's so, so irrational. Because it's like, why? It's good for me to do this. You know, I should be able to do that. I should feel no guilt whatsoever, but I do. And I work for myself. So no one else is saying that, you know, to me. So I'm just interested to hear your opinion on that. What is at the core of that voice? Why do we have that? What is it serving us? Is it holding us back? Like, help me understand why I feel that and why perhaps so many of us do.
I think that it depends first for person to person. We know that the amygdala has a certain set of fears that are always worrying for that part of the brain. So risk of reputational loss, risk of not being able to provide is a big one, though, that men feel. Oof. And it's an evolutionary, it's there for guys. And I've only just started to really understand this because now, you know, I work for myself and my wife is in sales. You know, she does really well for herself. But it's in the back of my mind all the time. It's like, what about the future? And I think that's the thought that keeps me as a man, at least, and I'm sure it's the same for many mothers as well, but that some of that is programming from how men have been perceived. But that kind of ends up driving me at certain points. How I get around it is being really intentional with my time. There's Parkinson's law that a task will expand to the amount of time given to it. The flow scientists, again, they're really big on scheduling in your calendar, knowing what are you supposed to be doing and when, having limits on what you're trying to achieve every day. If I'm able to be intentional with my time, say I'm doing this today and get that done, then I don't feel as much guilt. But if I've got 100 things and I haven't really dictated how I'm spending that time, then it runs wild. The amygdala kicks in, you're not doing enough, you're not going to be able to provide. You've got risk of reputational loss, risk of failure, risk of embarrassment, risk of just not reaching your own potential in your mind, risk of what other people say. And then ultimately, all of it leads to you will die in your brain's mind. You think you're going to die at the end of it.
Yeah.
And so then it gets out of hand really quickly.
It really does. Russ, did you want to share something?
I did. I mean, I think a lot of what I was going to say has already been covered. I think a couple of things. It's about that intentionality of time also, but you know, Alex, yeah, I can feel your pain about the guilt of not being at your desk. And I think as someone who now owns my own time as a business owner, it's a double-edged sword, right? For years and years and years, I worked for a company, whereas if I was at work, I was working, right? So it's that unwiring of, well, it's business hours and I'm not working, something's up. That's one thing. And I don't think you unwire your brain after, you know, decades of that rhythm to suddenly be fully understand you are the master of your own time. And you know, you may have the time to do something else during office hours, so do it. So it's difficult to do all that guilting. And I think, mind your comment about, you know, men and feeling guilty about that need to provide is on point also. So I think the solution is all about what you said about being intentional about time and then actually scheduling time to do things. At least for me, because I'm really good at sitting at my desk and going, oh my God, I've got a million things to do, and be a deer in the headlights for an hour because I'm so panicking about all the things that I've got to do. I don't actually tackle any of them because none of them, the time hasn't been scheduled, right?
Yeah.
And then you get to lunchtime and go, oh my God, I haven't done anything. And what did you do today? You know, I haven't done anything. All these things need to be done. And then you just, you know, the panic cycle just just continues.
You're reading my mind.
Yeah, it's about just being an adult, sitting down and scheduling the time to do the task. And like you say, not being distracted for 5 or 10 minutes, just actually sitting down and forcing yourself to just stick to the task. Because we've covered this in previous sessions, Alex. I'm the worst at getting distracted and then thinking I'm being really busy because I'm doing a million things, but actually not sticking to that single task that, you know, I should have been intentional about. So that was a very roundabout way to say I agree with everything that you've said. But it's really about ownership. When you understand that you own your time and you're intentional about how you spend that time, you know, you can actually be productive. And having easy distractions like cell phones, the worst case, the best way to destroy that, your best laid plans. Still haven't deleted all those apps.
Did you delete one though? Remember what?
No. But I am now more intentional about when I actually, you know, allow myself to get distracted.
Okay, good.
So we have, the progress has been made.
Well, yeah. Well, this is why this is a podcast now. So whenever you need a bit of extra inspiration, you can go back and listen to Manja's words of wisdom, Ross, to keep you on the straight and narrow. But thank you for sharing. Yeah, absolutely. That guilt and the need to provide, for sure. As just to go back to what you said specifically, also Manja, about the guilt that I think men feel, and of course this is nothing to say about all of the other things that women go through uniquely as well. But that is a very real kind of sensation and a reality, especially I think if you have kids, but maybe just also as a man. And as someone who's been doing quite a lot of work recently as part of a men's development group, I've seen that come to life in so many ways, where that pressure and that kind of expectation to provide and to keep providing, it doesn't stop, just seems to often be so relentless that, you know, we're not even aware of its effect, you know, in our lives, because it's so constant all the time, and you just got to deal with it, and you got to come up with a way to deal with it. So it's worth highlighting as something that really does exist. And anyone who's listening to this, it's worth just acknowledging that if you are providing, well done for providing, because often the provider also comes with so often a lack of acknowledgement, even if it's recognized, but the acknowledgement it really does need to come from somewhere. So yeah, we get it. Yeah. If we were to, Manja, if you were just maybe to wrap up before we go, to kind of, you know, sum up these tools, some of the things that we've talked about, the modern world as we kind of have it, and you know, the kinds of things that would be more healthy to start paying attention to, because in the beginning I mentioned the attention. It's about kind of reclaiming that attention, so that if you wanted to, you know, be able to be more open to asking for help, or stop procrastinating, you know, or changing the way that you limit your own beliefs. Is there anything kind of, you know, that someone can kind of take home for themselves to just start thinking differently? Perhaps even a question, prompting them with a question to just, for the first time even perhaps, start looking at a situation differently.
Yeah, I think the one really interesting thing to look at is, what have you learned is rewarding for you in life, right? What is rewarding for you? And if you really answer that question deeply and think, when was the last time I felt good about a purchase or something that I did, you'll quickly find that some of these things are scrolling, binging, looking busy, but not actually achieving anything, Googling self-help, reading these next ideas. And you'll find that's how you've learned to reward, that your brain has learned to reward itself, not actually achieving anything, but doing things. And I think once you're clear on your patterns, it's just getting aware as well that it's not your fault necessarily. It's just what you've learned and what the environment around you has shaped. So if you want to make a change, shape the environment around you. Get rid of your phone to start as much as possible. I've moved my phone when I sleep, and my sleep scores have gone up tremendously. And the only difference is the phone's not there. When I'm going into these flow states that we talked about, and I actually try and get something done, if the phone's not there, I'm infinitely more productive. So if we wanted to cut all the stuff into just one thing, is change your relationship with your phone and the technology that you have. Have more time without it. And that is the first thing you need to do, because once you do that and you see the results of it, that's going to motivate you to make further changes. The only other thing I would add is if you can do cold showers in the morning, contrast, just experiment with it, really sets you up for the day. If you can face a little bit of cold water first thing, I've been doing it again. I've seen health benefits. My resting heart has dropped massively. Wow. I think that really builds up that resilience muscle and that ability to handle discomfort and give you confidence for the rest of the day.
Wow, brilliant. So Rana and Ross, cold showers and get rid of your phone for a while. Does that sound doable?
Is
that...
How about no? cold showers is a step too far.
Is there a good way to start off with, like, maybe the last 30 seconds kind of turning it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's a contrast. It's not a cold shower. You go hot and then you just make it a little bit colder to begin with and experiment with pushing it every time. So I started with 5 seconds. Now I'm on 30, pretty cold. You'll be surprised at how quickly you adapt and how amazing you feel afterwards, because the body goes into a massive flood of dopamine.
Yeah. I think it's all just about having some physical activity in the morning, because that cold shower is just a substitute for, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'll whinge about not wanting to take a cold shower, but I'll go surf at dawn and then get changed in the parking lot.
Well, you can do that.
In like 8 degrees when the wind's howling, and then I'll whinge about cold shower. So, same result.
Yeah, absolutely. It's if you can start your day with some sort of movement, I think that's fantastic. That sets you up. It's not always possible, which is why I go to the shower. And then the phone. Yeah. You just get rid of the phone.
Mm.
Transformative, but no one really wants to do it.
I have a last question, just because I know that you work a lot with clients who are seeking, ways of... just improving their relationships and perhaps dating and love. What's your general thesis there? How do you feel that there's a parallel with kind of some of the self-mastery and some of the self, work that we've been talking about now, and how people, behave and the kinds of things that they really should be paying attention to improve their relationships too? Are there any interesting parallels and perhaps some differences in that
yeah,
work?
I think that with the dopamine side of it, what I've observed is many people feel that they're attracted to, they feel the attraction to someone, which is actually just a dopamine spike from chasing them. So you can have a person who kind of is giving you mixed signals, a kind of a will we, won't we, hot and cold. And you can think, oh, I really like that person. But that is a recipe for massive dopamine. So your brain loves the chase, and doesn't mean that's the right relationship for you. And so you have to kind of delay your gratification, be willing to give other people a chance to build a connection, to do things together, to really get to know someone, rather than just thinking, oh, will this guy or this person text me? That's a massive pitfall. And another way I think about it is, like we went back to earlier, we spoke about, you think that people are a certain way, or they'll say a certain thing, or that we have these types. If me and my wife met now on a dating app, we would not swipe on each other based on the dating advice out there. And probably, honestly, we just look at each other and on one screenshot, we wouldn't do it.
Mm.
Look at me, say, coach, what is that? Weird. We'd both look at each other and think, are they the right religion for what our families want? And we've been together for 15 years, had an incredible relationship. We've been married for four, been through so many different ups and downs, life changes. But if you just go around swiping on this type that you've got in your head, because you think it's this how these things are going to go, you might be missing out on your actual life partner.
Hmm. Wow. Interesting. Yeah. Hmm. And yeah, you've got me thinking now. Yeah. Wow. Awesome. Maybe just a final question. And I know I've said final, so this is the final question. Any kind of links or, you know, sort of events or, you know, other podcasts or things that you're doing where anyone else can catch more of you? I know that you've got your book out as well, The Art of Now, which I think is available on Amazon. What are you busy with now and what would be useful for people to know about what you're up to?
Yeah, so in the dating world, I'm creating some courses now and trying to make them as useful as possible. So they'll be coming out in the next few months. But really, I'm best to follow on Medium, where I write most of my articles, and on LinkedIn as well, where I share more of the kind of practical things for careers and self-improvement, not just dating. And those would be the best places, LinkedIn and Medium, as I think you already posted in the chat.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation. And I think it's been such a valuable addition to the conversation that we're having ongoing at Humble Mind. If anything, you've given us a great glimpse into the humble brain and kind of how it works and how it really runs our lives in so many different ways, but also some really great, you know, tools and ways to think, I think quite simply as well, about how to, you know, how to deal with that anticipation of a goal, the dopamine cycle. You talked about flow, which was great. Understanding the value of discipline and habits and so on. And I think that these help us not just to navigate the modern world, but also to really live up to what it means to have a humble mind, which is, you know, an open heart and an open mind. So thank you. Thanks for sharing your contributions and your wisdom. And I really hope to have you again here soon.
Thank you, Alex. Absolute pleasure. And for the rest of the community as well. Anytime. Always amazing to speak with you. Always learn something new as well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Humble Mind. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're curious to take a look at our community, if you're not a member, you're missing out. Make sure you head to humblemind.co to check out more and to see what we're up to. I look forward to seeing you there. Until next time.